Elf, welcome to 3CR.
Thank you for having me.
Tell me about Swan.
So Swan is a very silly comedy show. Just pure silliness for silliness' sake. It's me trying to tell the entire story of Tchaikovsky's Swan Lake, the ballet, and literally explaining it beat by beat whilst trying to do ballet and also do it in French and using mime and prop comedy and lots of clowning, a tiny bit of audience interaction, but very gentle audience interaction. They're definitely helping me more than me trying to use an audience member as a joke. And I made it nearly 10 years ago when I was 25, 26, and now I've brought it back as a 34-year-old woman. And yeah, it's totally silly, really fun.
Tell us about the clowning.
Well, the clowning is, clowning is people's perception of it is like circus clown with a big red nose. It's more just showing your thought processes with the audience and being very light and having an idea of what you're going to do and knowing how you're going to execute it, but giving a lot of space to discover new things with that audience in that time. You know, when you see a stand-up comedian and it's like very like ba-boom, 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 and you have a feeling it doesn't really matter if you're there or not there. They'd say it the same way. With clowning, it's ping pong. The audience is so integral to how the show lifts and how the show succeeds.
Tell us about the 45 bras.
The bras is a reveal that I don't want to give too much away from. But let it be known it's for a very seductive and sexy part of the show, which every day goes wrong, which I have had to accept is why it's so funny. Because I try so hard for it to go well, and then it always goes wrong. So I won't reveal any more.
How punk is Swan?
I suppose it depends what punk... I mean, how would you describe punk?
I think punk is edgy and subversive and adaptive to the modern times, doing subversion against whatever's modern and the status quo.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what the show is, I think. It's interesting doing it as an older woman. Like, I'm only 34, but it's fascinating how, especially I think very, very now with online social media, and anyone who's my age or actually anyone is just inundated with adverts about aging and about getting your face done. And I think it's more... more ingrained than ever, and my body is used a lot in the show. It's a very physical show, and you see a lot of me in the show. And it's very interesting how the female body, it is immediately sexualized in a way that the male body, when it's naked in comedy, can still be very silly. While the moment I do it, it becomes a sexual object, and then trying to go against that, and I suppose just not really giving a flying muck about, yeah, I'm very in your face, and I do what I do. I think it's the only way I can describe it. But a lot of people have described it as being very punk, and the reason I don't think you can call yourself punk. I think, like, you can't call yourself a clown. It has to be given to you by someone else. Like, you can't say you're cool. Someone else has to describe you as cool. But a lot of people have seen the show and gone, it's very punk. So I think, there we go.
Isn't that wild? You can be 34 and social media is just throwing, the algorithm is throwing anti-aging propaganda at you.
Well, it's that funny thing, isn't it? It's like we're dating or meeting people now. Like, I find it really interesting, like, being as like a queer woman, actually, when I date, like, I've always found this, being 34, like, I still find it, and maybe it was because of how I was brought up or internalized homophobia, but like I always find it very difficult to chat up women because I think I'm still internalizing the idea that I'm a threat. You know, when you were brought up, like if you were taught that it was bad, like I find it very hard to chat up girls because I just don't ever want anyone to ever feel like they're being pressured into anything the way I was often made to feel by like boys chatting me up, or like men could be very like dominant, and because I'm very tall and I take up a lot of space, I don't want to ever be. So I get very, very shy and interacting with people. And I think as you get older, like being a 34-year-old woman and the way I interact in the space, it becomes even more prevalent that I worry that I'm especially when you become more, you've got more power, like as a comedian on stage, or like more power in the comedy world, or like more influence. I don't ever want, when I'm using my audience for audience interaction or anything, or using my body on stage, I don't want to ever cross any boundaries. For me, boundaries and scent and consent are so integral in every aspect of my life, and like in comedy and in clowning, it can be crossed frequently, I think. So making sure that, does that make sense?
Like, yeah, you sound really ethical.
I'm trying to be. I mean, you know, everyone's ethical until they accidentally, you know, not until they accidentally buy something. They go, oh, no, this is definitely not an ethically made product. But, yeah, I think for me it really matters that the audience know that they can trust me and that they are safe. But it has, you have to be very, you can't ever tell an audience, you can't say to someone, you're safe, because it's not for you to decide. They have to decide that they feel safe.
So you're really tuned into your audience, and I guess that goes with the ping, 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 ping of your show.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the show is whoever the audience are that day, and is whoever I am that day. The script is only one aspect of it. The jokes are only one aspect of it. We've had that, and you know that, like, it's like you're a great interviewer, but sometimes it doesn't matter how happy you are, how ready, how great your questions are. If the other person's not in the vibe, that interview is going to go down like a lead balloon, and it's just going to feel like the most abrasive, awkward thing. It's the same with audiences. If I can be so warmed up, so ready to play, and if that audience are just sat there, arms crossed, quietly contemplating whatever I'm doing, it's going to be a really hard show. Even if they're a very kind, happy person, if they don't lift something within them to help, it's... And you think, oh, well, it's about the comedian to bring it out of them. You're like, no, we've all got to walk into that space willing to be lifted.
So you really adapt to the audience.
Yeah, really. Like, yeah, and obviously, you know, it's not always perfect. Sometimes you can be the calmest, most zen performer in the world. But I have performed to show audiences where they are so quiet that you are like, come on, guys, come on, like, you do not lose your temper, but you do get a bit spicy and say, we can't be operating like this. You're going to have to do something.
And so how do they respond to that? Does that kind of circuit break?
It depends. Sometimes people get just taken outside of themselves. A couple of nights. Melbourne, I would say, it's so funny. Different places always take pride on being great at laughing. Melbourne, I would actually argue, is a very quiet audience. Melbourne is a lot more, they sit back and they... I don't know. It's so interesting. Every different city has its totally different language. Melbourne do laugh, but they laugh in very different places to Adelaide, very different places to Perth, very different places to Sydney. You chat to different comedians and they'll have places they prefer to perform in. I think the UK are much more verbal as a place to perform than other places around the world. So I found when I come to Melbourne, I sometimes have to joke and go, hey, I know we're having a great time, but if we could make those smiles audible, that would be amazing. And people tend to really laugh at that, or just relax and calm, because you're not telling them off. You're just telling the audience what you need. And the audience are happy to know what you need. Because obviously we know that you need to laugh. But I think audiences are so... They have so much trust that you're happy doing what you're doing. They forget that actually you are still a little human being with flesh and blood and veins who needs a little bit more positive reinforcement to do your job.
Did you imagine yourself being a comedian when you were growing up?
Yeah.
You did?
Yeah, I was kind of, I knew I wanted to do it when I was 16.
Really?
So, yeah, so I kind of like, for my family are very high, we're very high achieving, very quite, you know, we're all neurodivergent, very like, and the moment I decided I wanted to be a comedian, my parents were like, okay, well, put your time and energy into it. But I did lots of other things alongside doing comedy. So I didn't become very good, or I didn't get signed until I was 24. But then this show, Swan, got nominated for Best Show at the Edinburgh Comedy Awards when I was 26, which is still pretty, I think, probably quite impressive. And it was nominated the same year as Hannah Gadsby's Nanette. So we met at the same time. And I think I was like the second youngest person to get nominated for the main award. So it was like, I always knew I was going to do, I look back on my life, I feast on it and go, we've done good, kid. We've done good.
What was it like when you met Hannah?
I'm lovely. Like, we just met. We had, it was at the awards, like, photograph thing. And we were both, I think we were the only two people that weren't still drunk when we turned up at the award photo session, because it was at 9 a.m. So we both sat and we had a herbal tea downstairs and just chatted about art. And then we sort of remained friends, like, ever since. But, like, yeah, very cool. It's the beautiful thing when you have other people in the industry, and all our careers take very different trajectories, and we all do and move into different realms. And it's so lovely to see each other and go, isn't this cool? You know?
Tell us about your life in the UK.
I don't know. It's very dynamic. I mean, what's your life like here?
I was just saying off mic, I live with cats and my ex-partner in a really old house in Melbourne, and being surrounded by a prine of cats, a family, is really, really calming.
See, this is it, because all my stuff is in storage. I think I've been on tour for nearly 2.5-3 years now, with different shows. I've done toured like 4 or 5 different shows now in this time, so you can probably tell by my voice. But my stuff is in storage. I travel like 7 days of the week around the UK, gigging, touring and teaching and directing other artists. For a brief period of time, I moved back in with my folks, just to, like, you know, need family love. And then when I come back, hopefully I'll be living in the seaside with an ex-partner of mine, because we both love each other and we're like, let's just live not in London, because London is becoming a hellhole. Let's just get out. But then I'll come back to the UK. I land in May from, I tour here of Australia, then go to New Zealand, LA, arrive back in May, then do a gay cruise for a week, for 10 days around, like, the Scottish and, like, Ireland, the coastline, performing there. And then I build my new show, Woman on the Edge, which I'm also doing whips of here. And then I tour that in Edinburgh for the comedy festival, and then I'll tour that. And then I'll tour a bit more, and then I'll probably come back here next year touring that out here as well. So it's the unrelenting movement of being a nomadic carny.
Tell us about the gay cruise around the Scottish Islands. That sounds amazing.
Oh, I did a gay cruise with Vaikaya. They are really fun. I did a gay cruise for them. Like, I mean, they're just LGBT, like, safe space cruises. And I did their one in Alaska for a week in July, and I had such a ball. It was so much fun, so silly. And also, it was like 2,000 gay men, 100 lesbians, and like 100, you know, like non-binary. You know, there were lots of different people there, but it was predominantly blokes, and it was just carnage, absolute carnage. But I had a lovely time. I spent most of it in the library reading thrillers and then looking at the glaciers, looking at the nature, whale watching, porpoise watching, and then doing comedy in the evening.
Tell us how London has become a hellhole.
I mean, it's just very busy, very smoggy. Have you been to London?
A long time ago, and yet reminded me of Chicago, similar kind of size and a bit grungy.
Yeah, I was born and raised in London. Like, I've known it since I was a kid. My family are all from London. Like, I've known it for a very long time. For me, it feels so, I mean, the expense, it's too expensive. It's so expensive. It feels very aggressive now. Like, it's so populated. It's so busy. But, like, everyone is angry. And you feel, like, a lot of disparity between how people live. There's a lot of, like, difference. I think people are a lot less connected and together, and there's a lot less community than I felt like there used to be. It's just, and it's impossible to make a living there. It's impossible to live. Like, all your earnings will go on your rent and your accommodation and food. You can't build a life there, unless you've really got a huge leg up from the get-go. It's not funny. It's just the realities of, I think it's just the economics of populations.
And no wonder people are angry, because that just sounds hopeless.
It does. It feels up. I mean, obviously, there's great beauty there. There's great beauty in the art scene. There's great beauty in every place you go to. You can always see the beauty. But also, if all your money from every job that you're doing is going on your rent, and everything is expensive, and it takes an hour at least to get anywhere, you can get, and a glass of red wine is like £9, which is what, $18-$19 here, and that's not nice red. That's, or my rent for London for a one room bedroom in a shared house would be the equivalent of $2,600 here, and that was considered very affordable. So like, I wow. think that's people's, so when other comedians want to come and move to London, we laugh way more in the UK than you do in Australia. We laugh way more, but I think it's because we're much less happy because you have nice, you've got, I think, a better balance of quality of life. It feels like here.
But the tension is that people worry that that is slipping away as well. Yeah. And I mean, places like London are kind of, you know, ahead of us in terms of the global kind of socioeconomic situation, that we kind of look at places like that and think, geez, is that where we're heading?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't comment enough because I only travel into these cities for very brief drops of time, and I see them when they're not their true selves. Like, I go to Adelaide during the Adelaide Fringe when it's so full of, well, it's still not so full of people, but it seems very, very busy, and then you find out that that's the only time of the year where everybody's out because it seems to be the only time anything happens in Adelaide from what they tell me. So it's unfair for me to make a full call on what Adelaide's like. Same when I come to Melbourne. I stay in Fitzroy. My shows are at Malthouse. Most of the gigs for comedians are in the CBD. I'm gigging 6 days of the week, working those 6 days of the week. Monday's my only day off, but then I'm doing radio interviews. So it's not like I have time to get in the car, drive out and see. It would be so unfair for me to make any informed judgment. And yeah, so that's why you can't really, I'd have to spend a consistent amount of time before I do an economics podcast with my dad called Elfonomics, and we break down different topics like this, like, why is this so expensive? Why is coffee so expensive? Why is the Edinburgh Festival so expensive? But it takes a bit of time to do the research before you say anything.
Why is the Edinburgh Festival so expensive?
I mean, well, obviously competition. Competition is key. So you've got more people coming in, which means people can raise their rents. So everyone is charging. It's now cost like thousands and thousands for a room. And it can, because that's the competition. So people can do that. It's a free market. Anyone can apply. So obviously lots of shows come. So you've got a wide array. So again, more people competing for audiences, more people competing for PR. So the PR can charge more. Venues charge more. Like, very basic thing. Like, yeah. I mean, I don't want to go into the full economic. You can listen to the episode. It's very good.
What is your favourite city to perform at?
Oh, I mean, London, obviously. Edinburgh. I really like going to Iceland, Reykjavik. I performed in Reykjavik a few times and I really love their vibe there. They're very dark. They're really twisted.
Twisted?
They love the darkness there.
I guess because they have so much of it, right?
Yeah. And Oslo, once I understood the people of Oslo a bit more and I'd performed there enough times, I really do enjoy going back there. I always like going to Amsterdam to perform, but then Amsterdam is very, very multinational, like lots of English speakers. So you get, and they again, they've got a kind of twisted sense of humour. There are some places that I don't like performing in, but at the same time, I would never say.
Yeah.
You just go, oh, well, I'll give that a miss. Make my life easier.
I'm fascinated by Oslo. Tell us a bit more about the culture there that you experience as a performer and kind of, yeah, tell us about that.
I mean, I don't know how to answer. I'm trying to think, like, when you go there, I suppose from my experience, they take pride on being a very, like, equal society, very great equality between the sexes. But actually, when it comes to being on stage as a female performer, you don't necessarily experience that. There are far less, it feels like, less female comedians. It feels much more backward, 10, 15 years behind than other places. So when you come on stage and you're very like in their face as an alternative performer, as a female, and also incredibly confident, and like you're not afraid to push things. I remember them, the first couple of shows, the audiences were a bit thrown. And then after like 5, 10 minutes and they work you out, they go, oh my God, and then they get into it. And I really enjoyed watching that unveiling, because I'd often be on gigs where I was the only woman on the bill and also the only one not speaking in Norwegian. So you're doing a gig and all the other boy acts are doing Norwegian, and then you come on as a woman speaking English. It's a big, a lot of rewiring for the audience. And so for me as a performer, and I always watch the other performers regardless of if I don't understand the language, because you can learn so much about what the audience is like, because you just follow the breath patterns and see what they're giggling at, see where they feel safe.
Elf, it has been wonderful to chat with you today at 3CR. Your show Swan is happening at the Malthouse Theatre until April 19.
It is. And I'm also doing a work in progress called The Woman on the Edge at The Greek on Fridays and Saturdays.
Oh, tell us a little bit more about that before you go.
That is a verbatim love story inspired by Apollo 13 and inspired by a very big breakup I went through last year, and then a spur-in-the-moment trip to Thailand I took. And very different to Swan, but very, very exciting. So you could go and see both.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us today on 3CR.
Thank you.
3CR.